Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hacks is back for season 3, and so is the official Hacks podcast. In each episode, Hacks creators Lucia Aniello, Paul W. Downs, and Jen Statsky speak with cast and crew members to unpack the Emmy-winning comedy series.
You'll hear Hannah Einbinder and Jean Smart speak to their on-screen dynamic, along with stories from the show's writer's room, on-set antics, and creating the world that Deborah and Ava inhabit. Watch Hacks, streaming exclusively on Max, and listen to the official Hacks podcast on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
Look out, it's only films to be buried with a Rewind classic. Hello everyone, it's me, Brett Goldstein. I'm just taking a little break so that I can focus on some work. I hope you understand. In the meantime, I'm putting out some of my all-time favourite episodes, starting with this one, with the fucking brilliant Barry Jenkins. Barry Jenkins is one of the all-time great filmmakers. I was so excited I got to talk to him. We recorded this around the release of The Underground Railroad. If you've never seen that, you really have to. It's incredible. He's an amazing man. This is an episode where I spend about an hour trying not to say I love you. I think it's a classic. I hope you enjoy listening to it again, or for the first time. In other news, you can get everything you want at the Patreon, at thepatreon.com/Brett Goldstein, where you get extra questions with Barry, you get the whole episode uncut, ad-free, and as a video, and all the back episodes as well. Shrinking is still available on Apple TV+. The first 7 episodes are out now. It's the show I co-created with Bill Lawrence and Jason Segel. We're very proud of it. Hope you're watching it. Hope you're loving it. And then the other big news is that Ted Lasso Season 3 will premiere March 15th on Apple TV+. Finally, it's here, and we really, really hope you love it. One last thing, I'm going to be doing a stand-up show in Seattle, April 8th at The Moor. If anyone lives in Seattle, wants to come and see some stand-up, come along that night. It's at The Moor. I don't know where that is. You live there, you tell me. Don't tell me, I'll find it. I've got Google Maps. Hopefully see you there. So that is it for now. I hope you're all well. Thank you for listening. I very much hope you enjoy this Rewind classic with Barry Jenkins.
Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. It is I, Brett Goldstein, and I'm joined today by a writer, a producer, a director, an Academy Award winner, a hero, a legend. I cannot believe he's actually doing this podcast. Can anyone believe it? Please welcome to the show the incredible, the amazing, the brilliant, it's Mr. Barry Jenkins!
Thank you, bro. Thank you, man. It's a pleasure to be here.
Barry, I can't believe you're here. You may never have listened to my podcast, but if you had, you might not have wanted to do it because I've spent a lot of time talking about your films in a loving way. What I do need to know before we start is what your tolerance is for being told how brilliant you are, because I'll limit it depending on how much you can take.
Very low. Very low. Very low.
Makes you uncomfortable.
Yeah, it does. It does. It does. Because one, I don't believe it. You know, I don't believe it. I don't buy it. Also, in a Roy Kent kind of universe, it's like the last thing you ever want to hear. I'm not that into it.
Okay, I'm going to hold back a little. I'll try. But what I will say is, I've recently completed the Underground Railroad. Congratulations.
Thank you, man. Thank you, man. Thank you.
What a phenomenal piece of work. And I did want to ask you, if I may, just a little bit about it, only because sure. It's the last one. Like, it's fucking incredible, and it's an incredible achievement. Aside from everything, just the size and scale of it, it's beautiful, it's harrowing, it's just an incredible piece of work. But genuinely, I'm curious for you. Like, it's a harrowing watch. It's a hard watch. And to have lived in that space and to make it, which I'm assuming took a year minimum, if not more, the whole thing for you.
Exactly.
How was your brain during the making of that? As in, do you switch it off at the end of the day? Were you stuck in that dark space for a very sustained period of time? Like, how do you exist making something like that for such a long time?
Yeah, it was interesting. I couldn't turn it off. There was just no way. I think when you're doing something at that scale, there's always a problem that needs to be solved or always a question that needs to be answered. And so my brain just had to constantly be going, had to constantly be in that space. And, you know, one of the things I'm really proudest of with what's happening in my career right now is I'm still working with my friends, you know, with people I've known since I was in an undergrad, since I was in college. And I think that helps, man. I think it helps a lot because it kind of takes, you know, and you guys are working at a really high level right now. So I'm sure there's a lot of noise in the system, as they say, you know, when you guys went back to do season two, and a lot of that stuff, it can be distracting. The thing you're doing, the thing you're creating, is a distraction to a certain degree. It separates you from yourself, from your real life. And then you got all this other shit surrounding it. But I think because of that, it's really helpful to always have my friends with me because I'm never alone, even when I'm like stuck inside this thing. And this thing was like, it was massive. There was just nowhere to hide from it. And then there was no way to really turn it off. If you did turn it off, something was going to falter or fail. And so, no, man, I was just in that headspace the entire time. But I wasn't there alone. And I think that made the difference.
Yeah. I mean, the cast is incredible. It's so well cast. But again, just the scenes that are being enacted are often traumatic. And I wondered, again, in terms of the length of time you were doing this for, whether there was a lot of laughter on set, whether, you know, between takes it was light, or whether you actually, everyone was in a kind of mood that sustained. Like, how did that work? Was it different?
No, there were certain days. I mean, in the first episode, the scene where the character, Big Anthony, is burned alive, essentially. That day, you could hear a pin drop on set.
Yeah.
You could hear a pin drop. It was just, you know, there's a guy in the show named Ben Walker, who plays the plantation owner in the first episode. His wife is English, so he actually lives in London, even though he's from the state of Georgia. He's from where that episode takes place. And so I remember one day we were beginning that day's work. It was like maybe noon in Georgia, which meant it was maybe like 8 or 9 p.m. in London. And I was about to call action, and he took his phone out. And one of the PAs was like, "Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Walker. We're about to start working. You can't take your phone out." He goes, "Oh, I'm sorry, man. It's like 9 o'clock. I just want to call my kids and tuck them in." And the PA's like, "No, I'm sorry. Mr. Jenkins is ready to go." I walked over. I said, "Let that man get on his phone and call his kids, because he wants to remind himself that he is him and the character is the character." I was like, "Yes, Ben, call your damn kids. Tuck them in. And then come back and do these horrible things." And so, yeah, there were days where it was really intense, but there was so much laughter on this set. There really was. Tuso, who plays our lead, is an absolute clown.
I'm so glad to hear that.
Yeah, and then Joel and the kid who plays Homer, Chase Dillon, they were just like Laurel and Hardy. I mean, it was just like a laugh a minute. So we did have a good time.
I'm delighted to hear that. And my last question, because you're probably bored of talking about this. I know you've been talking about it a lot. But you're obviously in a position, you have loads of projects you could be doing. I know that having 6 projects in development and then one goes, and in the case of Underground Railroad, particularly because it was such a massive undertaking, is there a particular reason that you were like, "I'm doing this now," or was it just logistically it lined up, it was happening then?
No. This was, everything had to sort of pivot around this. This was like, you know, the big ass truck on the highway taking up all the space and the other traffic has to move at its speed. This was always the main thing. Part of that was, you know, coming off of the win for Best Picture with Moonlight, I knew I had probably the most cultural or industry capital I'm ever going to have. And I knew I needed a certain amount of resources to pull this show off. And so it felt like this is how I'm going to pay forward all the gains I've made, you know, from this very unexpected success in Moonlight. You know, I think images set around people like my ancestors' images set around the condition of American slavery, there's a certain business prospect of those images, which means there's certain financial capital that's given, certain budgets that are allowed for works and the subject matter. And this felt like, I'm never going to have this opportunity again. I'm the hottest I'm ever going to be, you know, so how do I cash in this chip?
Yeah.
You know, do I go off and make some blockbuster franchise so I can put more money in my pockets? Or is this an opportunity for me to really take a big swing and try to capture the essence of these people who I owe so many things to? Also, I'm 42, bruh. Well, I'm 41 and I'm turning 42 soon. This shit was hard, bruh. This was hard.
I can see that.
I mean, maybe someday, you know, I know you had Russell T. Davies on the show, and he sounds, you know, pretty. I mean, maybe when I think he's like 55 right now, hopefully I'll be a sprite, you know, and I'll have as much energy as he does at 55. But I thought, you know what? I don't know that I'm going to be able to do something like this at that age. I'm not going to want to, you know, I've got the energy. I've got the stamina right now. I should do it. And so that was why.
And did you direct it as one giant movie split into 10, or was it blocked out?
No. We did it in episodes, and we kind of had to.
Well, they're each like a film, aren't they? Yeah.
Exactly. They're each like a film. And even more logistically, you know, if she gets to a new state, there's a whole different cast, a whole different set of locations. You really are resetting. And it was good for me to compartmentalize. I think good for the cast, you know, especially like someone like Tussauds. It's recompartmentalized. It's like, okay, I'm in this deep, dark place. And now in 2 weeks, I'll be in a different place. It might be dark, but it won't be as dark.
It's funny you talk about Russell T. Davies. She's your Doctor Who. She moves to a different, every episode, new cast, new world.
Exactly. And it just refreshes you, man. It just refreshes you.
Well, it's truly incredible. And I have nothing but respect for you. But I have forgotten to tell you something.
Yes.
And I should have said it. I should have said it early, actually, and I made it. I did make a note to say it when we met. But
why are you thinking about that? Let me ask you. So how did Ted Lasso happen for you, man?
I mean, you know, there's a thing I say to people when people ask like how to get into business and everything, and my answer is always just fucking make your own stuff. No one's ever the magical phone is never going to ring. And
agreed.
Just keep making stuff, and hopefully one day someone will see your stuff. And if you've been doing it long enough, they'll look back, you'll go, oh, I've got loads of stuff for you to look at because no one was looking for years. And then having said all that, I did get a magical phone call. But I'd done a pilot for Bill Lawrence before and we'd stayed in touch. And then 2 years later, he called me literally out of the blue and said, I'm working on this show. I think you should be in the writer's room. And I then had a FaceTime with Jason to see if we'd connect and sort of fell in love. And then 2 days later, I was on a plane to LA.
Holy shit.
It was madness. Yeah.
I didn't realize you'd been in the room on the show.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, so then the other part of it is I wasn't meant to be in it. And then we were writing it and I realized, I felt, you know, without being a dickhead, I felt like a calling. Like I need to play Roy Kent. Like I really, really get it. But I also knew no one was thinking of me for Roy Kent because I've got a Muppets poster and I'm usually had up to that point been playing sort of bumbly, sort of sweet English guys. So I made a tape on the last night of the writer's room because I didn't want to make anyone uncomfortable. And I filmed 5 scenes. And when I left, I emailed it and I said, look, I've had a lovely time. I love the show. I've been thinking for ages I could play Roy, but I also know no one's thinking of me for this. If this tape is shit, pretend you never got it. And I will never ask you if you got this email. But if you like it, here's the tape. And then thankfully they couldn't be bothered to look any further.
Wow. That's awesome, man.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was a real, real magic. That is.
Yeah. I don't know how often that's happening, but I know the woman who's the lead on Rutherford Falls, I had the same experience. She was in the writer's room.
Really?
On Rutherford Falls. And I think everyone, in this case, like everyone realized eventually, I think you're this person that we're all sitting here writing. And now she's the star and in the room. Very cool.
Yeah. No, it's really, yeah, it's a fucking miracle, the whole thing. The thing, speaking of shocking things, what I forgot to tell you is you've died. You're dead.
Okay.
Okay, you took that well.
Your shit feels good, man. It's a lot more anime than I thought it would be. Okay, yeah. I'm with it.
You said you were tired, so maybe this is good. How did you die? You get to choose how you died. How did you die?
You know, it's interesting. I'm terrified. I was not expecting this question. They did not send me this one. You know, I'm terrified of flying, terrified of flying, but I do it all the time. You know, I mean, doing what we do, you know, we just do it all the time. And maybe this is a terrible thing to say out loud, but I've always imagined that I'm going to die in some kind of aviation catastrophe, you know, but I've imagined it. And I, even when I was in college, I wrote a short story about it, about being thrown out of the window of this plane and just almost like the things they carried, you know, and just having this really beautiful experience of just floating through the air to my ultimate demise, but accepting it, and then just really drinking in the experience for what it is. Very morbid, but
no, I love this. I mean, I appreciate you. You've not had the podcast. We talk about death a lot. It's very morbid. It's fine. You're in the right place. My question is, who threw you off the plane?
In this short story, I had a very awesome apartment, very high up in the sky in one of the world's tallest buildings, and a small commuter plane just sort of swept me out. That was that one. I know, very strange, but you know, but it makes sense. You and I are very close in age. You know, I was sitting in a classroom when 9/11 happened. And so the idea of planes and buildings is something that was just very jarringly seared into everyone's consciousness. I think that's where I woke up one morning. I just had this image in my head of me being thrown out of a building, you know, by this small plane that had no business being at that elevation. That's it.
That is a hardcore death. But as you fell, you were acceptance, and it was beautiful.
Gorgeous. I mean, oh my God. I don't remember my dreams very often, but that one, I woke up and I was like, I need to write this down.
So you were sucked out of a building and then fell beautifully.
Just float it, man. I mean, just float it.
Love it.
You know?
Do you worry about death a lot? Is it something you think about a lot?
I do when I don't. I think the inevitability of death is something that I've gotten quite clear on, especially in the last like 5 years. But yeah, especially working on this show too, you know, doing all this research about my ancestors, all these Black people who were brought against their will to the Americas, and death was just, you know, it was like breathing. It was like tea. It was like coffee. It was like breakfast. It was an inevitability, and it was very, very, very rampant. And so, yeah, I had to go to that place. And so I have been thinking a lot about it over the last few years. And man, just with everything that's happening in the world, I mean, the headlines over the last 3 days have just been terrifying. Yeah, death is a reality.
Having sort of thought about it a lot in the last few years, have you changed your feelings about it? Like, do you feel less worried or more worried?
Not less worried, because I love life, man. I love life. I do. I love the world. I think that what's happening here is so impossible. I think when you really take a moment to step back and look at anything, really, whether it's a human face, whether it's the flower, I know I'm sounding very hippy-dippy right now.
Don't ever stop.
There's just so much impossible, ravishing beauty in the everyday, in the completely mundane. And so in that way, it's not that I don't want to live, and yet I also think I'm not afraid of death, because it's such an inevitability. There's a writer I love who was giving a talk, this woman named Alice Sola Kim. And I don't know if she was quoting another poet or something, but she said, you know, write like you're dead, write like your parents are dead, write like everyone's dead. And that's how I go about my work now. You know, because I was talking about this fear of flying. Every time I get on a plane, this is really dark. I assume it'll be the last time I get on. Every time I get on a flight, I think this is going to be the one. Every single time, Brett. That's true. Every single time. It's why if I fly, anybody listen to this, if I fly somewhere to meet you, I want you to know that in my head, I am risking life and limb to get to you. That's what I think.
Yeah, if you're flying to meet someone, it means something.
But because of that, I also think that when I'm making choices about I'm going to direct this, or I'm going to write that, or even I'm going to read this, I'm going to watch that, I got to mean it, man. I've got to mean it. You know, it's why, you know, I wanted to do the podcast, because, I mean, I know, but now that you were in the writer's room, it is kind of definitely your thing, man. I just love what y'all are doing on that show. My partner's a filmmaker. She'll tell you, we'll be watching an episode. I do this. I'll pause because, like, how much time is left? I'll pause again. It's like, oh shit, I got 10 more minutes. All right, cool. Then I'll pause again. I've got 5 more minutes, man. I just love it because that is worth my time.
Man, that blows my mind. Listen, I'm not allowed to tell you how brilliant you are for an hour, but I've said it a lot.
You are not. You are not.
I really appreciate it. That's very exciting to hear. What do you think happens when you die? Do you think there's an afterlife or anything like that?
I don't know. You know, in my spare time, I try to read like really random shit. I love how every now and then my followers on Twitter are like, why does Barry Jenkins know so much about these random ass things? I become obsessed, you know? I'm terrified of aviation, so I tried to learn everything I could about it. I'm fascinated by death and life in general. And so I've been just doing random research on those things as well. What do I think happens? I'm not sure, bro. I'm not sure, but I think something happens, right?
Yeah, I think so.
I think something has to. The universe is so mysterious. I mean, it is crazy mysterious, Brett. I mean, it's like insane. Some of this shit that we're only now discovering puzzles the hell out of me. And it makes me wonder if we even have the capacity to discover everything or even the essential things. I think we're scratching the surface right now. I say all that to say death can't be as simple as we assume. It just can't be. There's just no way. I mean, the fact that you can sometimes walk down a street and, you know, I think for women, this is even more prevalent, and you can feel some creepy guy watching you without seeing him, without knowing his presence there.
Yeah, for sure.
There is something that we don't understand that is out there in all these spaces between us. And I think that extends to all these other things out in the universe. And so, you know, you go to a cemetery, that's a version of death, yes, but that can't just be it.
Everything you've said about how you feel about life and how you feel about death and the afterlife, I think it's all in your work. I think it's all... The thing that I was really fascinated with Underground Railroad, particularly because of how it's heavy. It's fucking heavy. It's, you know, there's so much trauma in it. But it is also clear from that show that you love life and the moments like... In episode one, where they run across the field together, it's such a joyous, it's fucking beautiful. And there's so much, particularly how you shoot the landscape and the sun, and there's an element, it feels spiritual, there's spirits everywhere. Like, I just want you to know that everything you feel comes across.
Thank you, man. It's not intentional. I'm trying to get to the point where I am just working from this feeling, from a spirit. Brett said the word first, although I probably did say it before, but I am trying to work just from the spiritual place. If that element is present in the thing that we're doing that day, actually, all of that is completely unintentional. It's meant to be just a really simple run across this field. And we had filmed the dialogue portion of that scene somewhere else. And just something, I don't know what it was, man. The sun was setting and I just called out. I said, hey, I think we should do the lines right here. And I think we should slow this down. Let's take a moment with it. And we shot it in slow motion. Again, not intentional. And after the first take, it was clear something else is happening here. Yeah. Like something else is happening here. Yeah. This is only last for like 2 seconds. It's 2021. There's a guy outside blowing leaves. But he'll be done in a second. I don't know if you can hear it.
I can't hear it.
Right as I'm talking about the spiritual run across the field.
That's fascinating that wasn't planned. Because it feels... This is the thing I love. And, you know, look, I don't think you can compare them. But it's so much different. But in the making of Ted Lasso, there's a thing that Jason always says of... Someone else's quote, but it's the thing of... Do 90% of the homework, but leave 10% so God can come in. You know that?
Exactly.
And there's very much that thing of like, there are things that turn up. We did so much work, so much planning, so much writing, but there are things in the show that happened on the day that happened with the right person walking in, or, you know, you follow that. And it's so fascinating because when I think it is channeled by the spirit or whatever you want to call it, it seems there's no other way you could have done this. It seems like the whole episode was building to this moment that came randomly there. It's so fascinating that.
Yeah, and I think in a way the episode is building to that moment, but it's kind of what you were just saying and what Jason talks about. I feel the same way. We're building to this moment, but we're not expecting to build exactly what's in our heads. You know, we're hoping to be building and building, and then you get there. I mean, it's almost like, I mean, this is lame, but it's almost like on the pitch. where you can plan and strategize only so much, but at a certain point, the flow of the game hopefully just takes over, you know? And now all the scheming and everything, now it's just will. It's just will, and it's just, it's spirit, it's essence, it's passion. You know, very, very, very Roy Kent thing to say.
Love it, absolutely love it. Oh, the one other thing I want to say, what you said is you and Lulu Wang, who is your partner, I love the farewell. I love it so much. And I just imagine the two of you go to bed at night and say, good night, genius. Good night, genius. And then you turn out the light.
No, not quite. Not quite. Like, did you remember to turn the lights on? Oh, lights off. Did you order this thing? Did you order that thing? Very, very. But I do feel very fortunate to, you know, to live with someone and share my life with someone who also, you know, understands the necessity for these things that we're talking about right now, that it's not just paint by numbers, you know, that if it is painting at a certain point, it's just throwing ink, you know, throwing pigment, you know, at a canvas and stepping back and allowing yourself to be, to be shown what the thing is that you're trying to create. It's very cool, man.
It's very, very beautiful. So here's the thing. You were right. There is more after death. There's a heaven. And in this heaven, it's fucking great. They got all your favorite things. What's your favorite thing?
Coffee, man. Shit, coffee, bro.
Hey, this place is made of coffee. It's wall-to-wall coffee. The seats are made of coffee. You almost regret loving coffee that much because there is so much coffee-type instruments there. But they're all very excited to see you, and they want to talk about your life, but they want to talk about your life through film. And the first question they ask you is, what is the first film you remember seeing, Barry Jenkins?
The first film I remember seeing, and I was trying to think of this, and there's a group of films around this window. I don't know why, but it starts when I'm like 7 or 8 years old. I don't know why, but all my movie memories kind of start there with like The Color Purple, Coming to America. But the one that I remember is this weird-ass film called The Hidden, starring Kyle MacLachlan. My uncle took us to a drive-in cinema, and we saw this very weird-ass movie about the alien comes out of his chest at the end. Do you know this film, The Hidden?
Is the poster like a black and white sort of thing with it, like a spirit coming out of it?
Yeah, exactly. That's my earliest memory of a movie. I don't know why, because I don't particularly care for that film. It doesn't really mean anything to me, but I do remember sitting in my uncle's like Buick LeSabre, and you know, we had the radio turned on to hear the movie, and it was at the drive-in, and the thing came out of his chest, and I was freaked out, man. That's my earliest movie memory.
Where was that?
This was in Miami, Florida, back when we had drive-in theaters, which was a really fun thing to do, man. You just pull up in the car, get some popcorn and soda, you know, have a few beers in the back, and you just watch this movie.
Do you remember thinking, I want to do this? I want to make films.
No, absolutely not, man. Absolutely not. It was so far beyond me. I do remember, I kind of like this. Movies are cool. Up to then, I'd only been watching like Saturday morning cartoons. It's like, this movie thing, man, these are pretty cool. I kind of like this.
Yeah. Okay. What is the film that scared you the most? Do you like being scared?
I do. So my mom, who, you know, I have a very complicated relationship with my mom. And it's interesting. She's not really a big film person, but for whatever reason, I think because there's been so many extreme things in her life, she loves horror films, It's like her main genre of films. She's always telling me about this TV network called Chiller. There's a TV network called Chiller. It's all horror films. It's all she watches. And so I've always been exposed to the horror genre. The film that scared me the most, though, was a Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which was a film I saw. I remember I got into film school and some kid said, hey, you should watch Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I was like, why would I watch that? He goes, it's actually a really good film. And I watched it and I was like, yo, this is a really good film. Also, this is fucking insane because it felt so real, you know, watching it. I watched it again, maybe like a year ago, and it's almost like a snuff film. I mean, it's very hardcore. And it freaked me out.
It's really unpleasant. It's really unpleasant. And it does feel, I actually weirdly think it probably has the dark version of what we've talked about, of this kind of letting the spirit in. There's a feeling of that maybe in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, in that it feels like it's let evil spirits in. Like it feels unsafe, that film.
Well, it feels unsafe. And thinking about the world right now, as a first, it doesn't seem so far-fetched, which is crazy. I remember watching it and going, this shit could happen. Like, this really could happen. Anyway, yeah, that would be my pick there.
That's a good one. What about crying? What's the film that made you cry the most? And are you a crier? You make films that make me cry. Are you a crier?
I'm sorry, Brett, man. Apologies for the tears. I can be a crier. I'm actually crying more now in my older age. Lulu and I were watching. We were watching this Netflix documentary on this K-pop band. I think they're called Blackpink. It's the name of this band. There's a Netflix documentary about them, and this is so embarrassing. But there's a moment where, because you know, their whole careers are in these huge mega pop stars, but they haven't conquered the American market. So they go and they play Coachella, and the documentary culminates with them playing Coachella. And you see them talk about the feeling of playing Coachella, the validation of it. And it just broke me, man. I was on the couch watching this teeny popper pop music documentary. And I was crying, man. I was crying real tears, man. Ooh, I was like, what's wrong with you? I'm really emotional. I was trying to finish Underground Railroad, you know. It was just this,
oh, yeah. You must have been a wreck.
But when I was a kid, the Neverending Story was the thing made me cry. You know, the scene where he's in the swamp with the horse.
In the swamp.
And the horse kind of like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was, yeah, it was, I had to do some growing up.
Yeah, that hit a lot of us hard. What is the film that people don't generally like? It's not critically acclaimed, but you love it unconditionally and you think everyone else is an idiot.
Yeah, I was actually surprised that Howard the Duck is not a critically acclaimed film. It was it was a movie I watched a lot as a kid. It was always on like television and I was just really into it. I would like, I remember the songs that he was singing. And I think Leah Thompson plays his girlfriend in the movie.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a really cool film, man.
Yeah.
And people say it, as you say, as Roy would say, people say it's shit. And I'm like, no, this is not a shit film. This is a great film. The other one was Last Action Hero came out, and I remember I was like, oh, this movie sucks. It bombed. It tanked at the box office. And I went and saw it, and I was like, this is actually a really good film. It's like a really fun film. So I would say those two. But Howard the Duck, man, I had no idea. I was looking it up on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
It got trashed. People hated that movie.
It was hated. I weirdly think both of those films were ahead of their time. Mm. Like, Howard the Duck is very weird, which nowadays is fine. And Last Action Hero was very postmodern and shit, which nowadays is fine. I think they were both, they flew too close to the sun too early or something. Interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hacks is back for season 3, and so is the official Hacks podcast. In each episode, Hacks creators Lucia Aniello, Paul W. Downs, and Jen Statsky speak with cast and crew members to unpack the Emmy-winning comedy series. You'll hear Hannah Einbinder and Jean Smart speak to their on-screen dynamic, along with Hacks writer and actor Pat Regan, on how their improv experience helped them when shooting scenes and what it was like writing scripts for specific actors.
You'll also hear from crew members like the costume designers on what it was like creating the world that Deborah and Ava inhabit. Hear stories from the show's writer's room, on-set antics, and more. Watch Hacks streaming exclusively on Max, and listen to the official Hacks podcast on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's the film that you used to love? You loved it very much when you were younger. You've watched it recently and you do not care for it anymore for whatever reason that may be.
So this is a combination with the last question of Last Action Hero, because when I was a kid, I saw Terminator 2 Judgment Day, opening day at the theater, big blockbuster. And I loved it. I thought, this is amazing. And I watched it recently. And I prefer Last Action Hero to Terminator 2 right now. I actually think Last Action Hero, to me, holds up better. You know, no shade to the maker of Terminator 2. He's a very big, important guy. But I will say, as a combination, I then rewatched the original Terminator. And that film is a masterpiece.
Yeah.
That film is a masterpiece. And talk about something that feels very real. I mean, just so very of its time in a very honest and dark way. absolutely amazing. Watching Terminator 2 and thinking of that film of its time, you know, it's a great piece of entertainment, but I just didn't have the same response to it, reaction to it, relationship to it that I had when I first saw it. Obviously, it's, you know, it's a 20, 25-year-old film, so maybe that makes sense. But then you watch Terminator, and it's like, oh, my God, this film is like, it is everything. So dark, by the way. So dark. I mean, even in the world with all these mass shootings going on, you watch Terminator, and it's like, yo, how was James Cameron talking about these things, you know, 20 years before, you know, they became, you know, every other week in our country, you'd have one of these things happen. So, yeah. Terminator 2, man, I just love that movie, but I just don't have the same feeling for it now. Terminator 1, though, masterpiece.
Terminator 2 is no Last Action Hero. Barry Jenkins. What is the...
What I guess is I the, did just say that.
No, I love it. What is the film that means the most to you? Not necessarily the film itself is any good, but because the experience you had around seeing the film that will always make it special to you.
When I was in high school, the first Scream came out, you know. Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah. It was a great, great film. Really holds up. But I went and saw that film like 3 times in theaters. And every time I went to see it, you know, me and my high school friends, we would go to random movie theaters and we would be in the, I don't know how we got away with this. We'd be in the back of the theater and we would sneak up on people and we would just jump scare the shit out of them at certain moments in the film because we knew the jump scare was coming. And the whole point is you don't know who was on the phone and who's this and that. And so it became like really fun thing. It was almost like a Rocky Horror Picture Show where we kind of made an event out of seeing Scream, you know, and we probably should have got our asses kicked, to be honest. But it made it really fun. You know, it's kind of just thinking about it. It came to me because I miss being in theaters, man. I miss being in a room with a bunch of people and, you know, one person laughs and now 8 people are laughing. One person jumps out of their seats, you know, and everybody's laughing or people are screaming. And in this film, when it came out, and especially too, it was just a more innocent time. I don't know that Scream would have the same impact today as it had back then, but that was an awesome movie going experience. I mean, just really, really awesome.
That's fucking fine. Oh, on a little side note, I saw, maybe you've already done it, that you were going to have a screening of Underground Railroad, the whole thing, at a cinema.
Yeah, last night, man.
Oh, how'd it go?
Yeah, it went great. I showed up just for the Q&A. I still can't quite do it, but I showed up for the Q&A. It was great to like be physically in a space with real people, and they had real ass questions, which made me give real ass answers.
Great.
Yeah, it was very cool, and also it just looks great on a big screen.
But you can't sit with an audience with your own work.
I am not, and also I wouldn't. You know, whenever Moonlight premiered, I didn't sit and watch it. When Bill Street premiered, I didn't sit and watch it. I just can't, man. That's torture. Do you watch Ted Lasso? Can you actually watch it?
Well, we had a premiere in LA. We had a proper premiere, and
that's right.
I didn't realize we had to sit because like once the thing, I was like, oh, we have to sit here and watch it. It's a very odd experience, but and I definitely sweated a lot. But on the other hand, it's slightly different with Ted Lasso in that when you could hear laughter, it was like, okay, this is going all right. It's okay. We're getting audible feedback. But when it's a drama, and I guess silence is how you know it's going well, if you're not hearing people shuffling and...
Yeah, silence is how you know, or I love in Moonlight, when the question in the very first chapter where the young boy asks the character Juan, I'm going to quote exactly what he says. He asks, what's a faggot? You could hear the whole audience, people just inhaled. And then you would hear people just keep the breath in, you know, until Mahershala, as this character, starts to explain. And you're just, the whole audience is riding this wave. Is he going to get the words right? There's nothing like it, man.
That's fucking cool, man. Okay, what is the film you most relate to, Barry Jenkins?
I couldn't come up with an answer for this one, man. It's interesting. I feel like I'm changing so much all the time that I have a hard time seeing myself in films. I do remember when I was a kid, Spike Lee has this film. It's one of his lesser known or less well regarded works called School Days.
Yeah.
It's you know, Lawrence Fishburne is in it, you know, a lot of really great actors who go on to become like the bedrock of the Spike Lee acting troupe. Giancarlo Esposito's in it. but it's about these, you know, all these black kids, you know, in college, you know, at a historically black college in the States. And it just, I knew black people went to college. I did. But seeing a whole world of just black people in college, it kind of triggered something in me. I was like, yo, this is wild. There's this whole universe of blackness that, because I'm so poor and I'm just from such a faraway place, you know, Miami's like the bottom of the US. It just didn't occur to me. And just seeing that film, I don't know, it just clicked. You know, it meant a lot to me, even though I didn't end up going to a university like that. Just even the confirmation that it was possible, I was like, oh. And this is weird. This is like 1990, 1992. At this point, it should be pretty obvious that black people go to college. But it's what they say. You know, I think there's something really powerful in actually like seeing someone like you in these spaces that you've maybe assumed or something about the world has passively confirmed. This space isn't for you. And so, yeah, Spike School Days, I'd say, is one.
That is a perfect answer. I'm going to give you 20 points for that. I've started scoring this.
Thank you, my friend.
Since you gave that answer. What is objectively the greatest film ever made? Might not be your favorite, but objectively, you go, that is the pinnacle of cinema.
Shit, that's a tough one. The pinnacle of cinema. It's a couple of films. I mean, Scorsese's got a couple. You got Taxi Driver, you got Raging Bull. You know, Spike's got Do the Right Thing. Ron Carwise got Love. But for me, you know, Claire Denis is my favorite filmmaker. And so her best film, I think, is the greatest film ever made. This film called Beau Travail. Just about these men in the French Foreign Legion. I just think it's a perfect film. You know, it's like 90 minutes. You get in, you get out. It's just nothing but the most essential elements of cinema. And you know what it does too, man? Because there are great films that tell really great stories. You know, you got Vertigo, you got North by Northwest, you got all these really Singing in the Rain, you know, all these really iconic, primarily, you know, old Hollywood films that tell a great story really in a really awesome way. But cinema, this combination of sounds and images, it's a whole different thing. If I want a story, I read a novel. Cinema, the combination of light, image, and sound, all these different things, the absence of light, the absence of sound sometimes, creating that, putting that into a very potent mix is very difficult. It's very rare. And this film is just, it is pure. It is pure fucking cinema. I mean, it is the purest. If I could like, just like scoop that up and put it in a little caviar jar and serve it, you know, just take a hit of it. That's what I do, bro. You know what I'm saying? Give me a print. Give me a print of Beau Travail.
You do it.
Give me a print of Beau Travail and sprinkle a little olive oil, some sea salt on it, and just give me a little wood spoon. And that's all I need, bro. That's all I need.
Did you see High Life, her film High Life?
I did see High Life. I saw it at the Toronto International Film Festival. Tricky film.
I saw that. That is one of those films that I saw completely on my own when I was in LA. I think writing Ted Lasso season one, I saw it in this very odd cinema and I fucking loved it. But I also left there thinking this is going to be a hard sell for anyone else. As in, I felt like I was in a particular mood at a particular moment that it really worked for me. But my goodness, that is a tricky film.
Well, and I think that's something that I really love about her work. And it's something that I seek out in the things that I watch. We're talking about death. We've only got so many movies we're going to get to watch in our lifetime, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think having an experience that is singular, yeah, that can't be had any other way. The things you feel watching High Life, you're not going to get that feeling watching too many other films, you know? I think there's something really, really lovely about that.
I wanted to read everything about it after I saw it. And I found like four podcasts that she had done where it was like Q&A's about the film. And in every single one, she was like, I have to be honest, I don't know. I can't really talk about films. I don't really know how I do them. I just sort of feel them and they happen.
Exactly. She operates. I mean, I love her. Legitimately, I love her. She operates on her own wavelength. And it's not about trying to orchestrate a reaction or to build some very clever epiphany or theory. It's just she's responding to the world. She's responding to the characters. It's a really wonderful way of working. I admire her greatly. She's amazing.
Yeah, for sure. She's following the spirit, for sure. Barry Jenkins, what's the sexiest film you've ever seen?
This is a tough-ass question. This is the question that I was like, how the fuck do I... Oh, and the follow-up question, by the way, very tough. but I would say Bound by the Wachowskis because...
Yes, please.
Matrix had come out, and this is back when you could actually go into a video store. So I watched The Matrix because I was actually working in the theater the summer The Matrix came out. So I saw it a lot. I saw it a lot of fucking times and thought, oh, this is very cool. How have I never heard of these filmmakers? And Blockbuster had this film Bound that the Wachowskis had made before Matrix. I was expecting this was going to be a very Matrix-y type film. And I think Gina Gershon was on the cover box and, you know, Carrie Ann Moss and the Matrix, you know, was wearing all the leather. I thought, oh, it's definitely the same people. And then I start watching this film and I was watching it, I think, with one of my film school roommates. And I just remember it getting very squirmy because this is, you know, I went to school in Tallahassee, Florida, the Deep South. And this is before, you know, so many things about, you know, the rights and lives of LGBTQ plus people were very out sort of in like the public conversation and the mainstream. And so I'm with this kid who I don't know and we're watching this film and Gina Gershon and Jennifer Tilly are very clearly, I mean, they are just getting after it. I was like, yo, I kind of feel awkward watching this with this person, but in a way I'm kind of like excited about watching this thing with this person. It's like, what the fuck do we do? And so I just keep watching this movie. And so at the end, I was like, how did the Matrix people make this thing? And why was that so damn sexy? So yeah, I would say Bound by the Wachowskis.
That's a very, very good answer. They really do go after it. It's a wonderful film. So let's deal with the subcategory to this question, which is troubling boners, worrying wide-ons. A film you found arousing, you weren't sure you should. I'm sorry, Barry. I'm sorry to even ask it, but I have to. It's on the list.
Yes, by the way, the worrying wide-ons is awesome. I don't think I've ever heard that. I don't know if that's an English saying, but I dig it.
Thank you so much.
You know, I think this is not so bad an answer. I'm going to go with Who Framed Roger Rabbit. You know, I remember watching that as a kid. And I think maybe because I was a kid, it was allowed. But I just thought Jessica Rabbit was fucking incredible. I remember I would have these dreams about Jessica Rabbit. And she's a cartoon. It's like this shouldn't be happening. You know, again, cartoons are one thing. They're very sweet. They're very innocent. I've been watching them my whole life. And now this cartoon is doing things. It is doing things. Again, I was a kid, so I think it was pretty allowable. But yeah, Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Yeah.
I think that's a perfectly legitimate answer. And it does blow my mind. It blows my mind how that works. Jessica Rabbit works. Because it does work. It entirely works for me. And it is a drawing. I don't understand how the world works like that.
It's a very persuasive drawing. I mean, it kind of does make sense. I mean, Playboy had cartoons back in the day. Or I had the little comic drawings, you know, for some of the editorials. So it makes sense. It makes sense. I wonder if they hired someone at Playboy just to draw Jessica Rabbit. And now Lulu's going to hear this and going to go, wait, we got to talk.
Before I say goodnight, genius, we need to talk about what you said. What is the film that you could or have watched the most over and over again?
There's two films. One film, I think, makes sense. I'm a really big fan of David Fincher's, really big fan of his. And I just find his movies to be just infinitely watchable. And The Social Network is a movie that, if that movie's on, I will watch it. If it's on, I'm just going to watch it. I'm not going to not watch it. You know, if I come into it and it's been on for 20 minutes, I'm going to keep watching the next like hour and 20 minutes. If it's been on for an hour and 10 minutes, I'm going to watch the last 10 minutes. I just find it eminently watchable. The way he makes his film, it's just like, it's a drug. The other one, and so I've seen Social Network a lot of times. The other one is very strange. Again, I'm a bit obsessed with death and terrified of flying. The combination of those two things, Charlie Kaufman has a film called Schenectady, New York, which many people, thank you.
One of the greatest films ever made.
I think it's one of the greatest films ever made. And Brett, I promise you, it's probably the film I've seen the most of any film because I went on this kick where anytime I would fly, I would put on Schenectady, New York. I had it on my laptop. I had it on my phone. I had it on my iPad. If I got on a plane, I would just put it on Synecdoche, New York. I was like, okay, I'm in this very heavy place because I'm getting on this thing that terrifies me. I just want to live in that emotion. This is the perfect time to watch Charlie Kaufman's Synecdoche, New York. With as often as I fly, I've seen it at least, I'd say coming up on 100 times, I've seen that film at least.
It's fucking amazing, that film. And similarly to how I felt in terms of Underground Railroad, is like, I don't know how he made it. I'm like, it's such a huge, just the levels of it, the scale of it. I'm just like, I don't know how he did this. And I'm sure you've read it, the screenplay, the published screenplay of it.
I have not read the screenplay. What I have done, though, is he came to London. He gave a BAFTA talk. Yeah. And his BAFTA talk, I keep on my phone, and we have the same birthday, he and I. Me and Mr. Kaufman, yeah. And so, yeah, he's somebody very meaningful to me. It's funny, you mentioned Underground Railroad. The production designer on Synecdoche, New York, is also the production designer on the Underground Railroad. So there's some connectivity there.
Amazing.
It's just amazing. Such a deep film, man. You know, I try not to take a moment. It's kind of why I wanted to do this podcast. One of your Twitter followers was like, hey, you should go on Brett's podcast. Brett's got a podcast? Take a listen. I was like, you know what? Cool. Maybe I should. We don't often get a time to like sit down and really just step back and just talk about shit, just random shit. And then talking about those things, reflect on what it is we do. And then a whole movie is Charlie Kaufman coming out of this decade of just like, I mean, he was the hottest of the hot. I mean, you know, I think he's a genius, but at this moment in the mainstream, it was like Charlie Kaufman is a genius. And that does something to you, man. It really does something to you. And this film was a very public display of all the neuroses and just everything that I'm sure was swirling within him at that moment. And he made a fucking masterpiece. It's a masterpiece, man.
It's incredible. Like, I think that there's so many things going on in that film, but one of them, I think, because I showed it to someone, they were like, oh, this is really depressing. And I was like, I don't think it is depressing. I think it's about a man who is so scared of death and illness that he thinks he's ill. He thinks he's dying the entire film. But he, in fact, outlives everyone. And in fact, it's sort of a celebration of life. It's just that he keeps not paying attention to the right bit in a way. Like, and I love, there's a moment, I think it's in the trailer as well, but when he's just rehearsing this play, he's trying to make this truthful thing. And there's a moment so far into the film when one of the actors say, when do we put it on? When is it happening? And he's like, it's not finished yet. It's never finished. It's never going to be finished.
Oh, yeah.
It's good shit.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's good shit, and it didn't do well. No. It didn't do well. And I don't know if it's because it's so honest. It's so brutally honest about what it is to do what he does, to do what Mr. Kaufman does, and what he had been doing so well and so consistently for so long. And I guess maybe that's the price you pay, man. That's the price you pay.
And it's very dense, and you need to watch it a lot. I mean, it asks a lot.
100 times, Brett. 100 times.
And that's you.
100 times.
That's what you did.
100 times. And yet you can recall the trailer.
You did the serving suggestion properly. Watch this 100 times, then we can talk about it. I love that. Fuck, I'm excited you chose that. And then that you had the same production designer. Congratulations. Do you know what? That's 100 points, that one. Now, there's a lot of humor in your stuff. You're very funny. What's the funniest film you've ever seen? Or the film that made you laugh the most, actually, is the question.
There you go. That's an easier question. Friday.
Yes. Friday,
by F. Gary Gray and Ice Cube. I mean, again, I was in college. Friday came out. Actually, there were two films. Friday and Half Baked both came out around the same time. And I just remember, you know, freshman year, you just go to somebody's dorm room, they put on Friday, and you just laugh your head off. You just laugh your head off. Or Half Baked, and you just laugh your head off. I think the first time I ever smoked pot, it was while watching Half Baked.
That's how you should do it.
I think so.
Underrated film.
Half Baked?
Well, yeah.
It depends on who's rating. It depends on who's rating, bro. Depends on who's rating. Because where I come from, it is a masterpiece. A masterpiece.
Fucking right. Fucking right it is.
And it was kind of the precursor of Chappelle, you know, doing Chappelle's show. Mm. I think it's one of his greatest works, you know, right up there in the hallowed halls of The Godfather, Raging Bull.
Yeah. Fucking absolutely right. I don't like to be negative. I don't think you love it either. Very quickly, what's the worst film you ever saw?
Oh, Birth of a Nation by D.W. Griffith. Next question.
You finally fucking nailed it.
Next question.
Correct.
Next question. Next question. That was an easy one. I was waiting for that one. That was an easy one. Next question.
That one came so much easier than the old troubling boner. Barry Jenkins, you have been beyond what I dreamed you'd be. I dreamed you'd be great. You've been fantastic. However, when you were in a building and a plane flew past and sucked you out the window and you fell many stories, and halfway down you were suddenly accepting of it and you thought, oh, this is quite nice, and you sort of floated down at peace with the world, and then you smashed into the ground, and I was walking around and I was like, where's Barry Jenkins gone? I thought he lived up in that tall building, but then there's this sort of crowd gather around and, oh, you're an absolute fucking mess in the pavement. I'm carrying a coffin. You know, I'm like always walking around with a coffin. And so I'm like, don't worry, guys, I'll take care of this. So I scoot you up, but you are like embedded in the tarmac. So I have to get a fucking digger, one of those JCB diggers, drill around your body, try and get as much as I can. It's a mess. It's really horrible. So stuff all the bits of you into the coffin. But there was far more with the tarmac and everything. It's far more than I'd planned for. And this coffin is absolutely jammed. It is full. There is really only enough room in this coffin for me to slide one DVD into the side with you to take across to the other side. And on the other side, it's movie night every night. And one night, it's your movie night. What film are you taking to show everyone when it's your movie night in heaven? Barry Jenkins, go.
Okay. When I had this vision, Synecdoche, New York did not exist. So I can't say Synecdoche, New York. I can't say that. Didn't exist. Movie hadn't come out yet. 10 years before Synecdoche. So I can't say that one. So I'll be honest. At the time of this vision, the movie of my life was a little film from the 1980s starring Bruce Willis called Die Hard. And so I think Die Hard, if I'm being honest, I think at that moment in my life, having this vision, Die Hard would have been the film. It would have been. It's funny, you asked earlier, is that the film that sparked that you thought, oh, maybe yeah, I could do this today? Die Hard was the first film that gave me an inkling of, oh shit, people make movies. Maybe I could do that someday. Very random, Brett. Very random.
I love it. Die Hard has done so much good in the world. That's fantastic.
Yes, it has. Yes, it has.
Barry Jenkins, you've been wonderful. Is there anything you would like to tell people to look out for, to watch? I would certainly say if you've not seen it yet, get on the Underground Railroad. Is there anything else you would like to tell people to look for?
Yeah, I would say get to the Underground Railroad. Yeah, and if you have watched it or you haven't, there's a little side piece or an addendum to the show, this piece called The Gaze, that's on my Vimeo page. It was, as we were making the show, we were paused making the actual show, and we would just record these portraits of primarily our background actors. And we didn't know what we were going to do with them, but I think it just captures the essence of what was important to me about making the show. And I describe it as being an opportunity to visually, you know, get a depiction of my ancestors. And it's 50 minutes. There's no dialogue. It's just score and people staring directly into the camera, directly at you, the viewer. Mm. And I'm very proud of it. So I would say, seek out The Gaze.
Amazing. I'm going to watch that when we get off this Zoom. Barry Jenkins, I mean, you're brilliant. I know I'm not allowed to say it, but let's say it. All right, you are. Thank you for doing this. I really, really appreciate your time. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk with you.
The pleasure is all mine. And Brett, I don't know if people often say it. I'm going to say it back to you on the show. You are brilliant, my friend. It has been an honor to talk with you, Brett. I appreciate it.
All right. Get out of here. Be good.
So thank you very much for listening. That was a Rewind Classic. Join me next week for another Rewind Classic. Hope you're all well. Stay safe. Stay good. And remember, now more than ever, please, be excellent to each other.
Welcome to season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.